So good evening, everyone. It's great to see you here, and welcome to this event on the special occasion of this event, which hopefully you've seen on your chairs, is this fabulous book by Stephanie, which we will discuss. But we also have an amazing panel to give a very different set of insights on the theme of the book. And before I introduce the panel, I just want to say some practicalities. Please turn your phones on silent. Also, this is an event by the LSE Department of Government. And finally, if there are sort of any Twitterati in the audience, we have a hashtag, LSE Spend to Win. That's quite a cool one. So please use it, and then you'll be retweeted endlessly by the LSE, so that's great. So tonight we have three excellent speakers. I will introduce them in turn. I'll first talk about Stephanie, whose book we're here to discuss, who's a professor at the Department of Government. She has produced a great series of scholarly insight of something that has recently become more salient, which is namely international trade negotiations and the influence of domestic politics on international trade. Who would have thought that that matters, but we figured out that it does. But her book today looks at something quite different, namely national politics, national government spending in particular. And what the book asks about is why governments provide sort of particularistic economic subsidies when subsidies like that are costly in a number of ways. It's obviously costly because it costs tax money that could have been spent on more general things like housing or welfare or education or hospitals and so on, and provide them to specific groups, specific geographical groups or specific businesses. So why would governments do that? And she provides a very clever yet quite simple answer, which is to understand that we really need to combine to both look at economic geography, so how economic activities are concentrated or not in a country, and the particular electoral system. And why is that the case? It's the case because, and here I agree as a political scientist, but we'll hear later whether the rest of the panel agrees, it's because ultimately governments want to win re-election. So to have the ultimate strategy to do that, they need to look at both how they're going to win re-election, i.e. what does the electoral system look like, and what are the particular economic interests in a country? How are preferences aggregated or disaggregated? I think it's an amazing argument. I was entirely persuaded. Let's see if all of you are later. So Stephanie will summarize this argument much better than I. And then afterwards, we have the amazing honor of having two people who look at similar questions but from a very different perspective than the sort of political science perspective. Firstly, it's a real honor to have Hilde Huckelberg here, who's the director of Innovation Norway. And Innovation Norway will be introduced by Hilde later, but it's an organization that's charged with allocating government subsidies by the Norwegian government. I'm sure you all know that the Norwegian government has a lot of money to allocate. It's a source of great jealousy from my home country of Denmark that they found so much oil. But that means, of course, they have great experience. And Hilde will really talk to us about this subject from the perspective of this execution by the government. And then last but not least, Chris Giles is here joining us from the Financial Times, where he is economist editor. He's been that, I think, since 2004. In a previous life, he also served as economist for the IFS. And he is, as you'll know, if you read, which I hope you do, the Financial Times, that he's a very insightful commentator on government economic policies. So that will be, no doubt, a great panel. But we'll start with Stephanie, who will talk about her book. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, thank you all for coming tonight. As Sarah said, it's really an excuse to celebrate the launch of the book. It's been out for a couple weeks in the United States. It's coming out tomorrow in the United Kingdom, so I'm really excited to celebrate with you today. As you know, writing a book is a long and torturous process. Along the way, you need a lot of support, and many of you in this room tonight have really helped and support me through this process, so thank you. Especially thank you to my husband, Shane. Without him, this book would absolutely not have happened, so thank you. I was motivated to write this book by a really interesting puzzle. I looked around at these rich, wealthy, highly democratic countries and saw big variation in how willing they were to support businesses and industries and sectors in their economy. And this was puzzling. They're all democratically elected countries, but they're doing very different things vis-a-vis their economies. And so, for example, we see big differences in how much money governments spend on subsidies for businesses. France, on average, spends 3 to 4 times as much money on subsidies for businesses than Italy. Even in times of economic crisis, we see big variation in how governments respond to help their domestic producers. So in the light of the 2007-2008 global financial crisis, we saw some governments really coming up to help their producers. We saw the UK, the United States, France, and Italy bringing big money to bear to help their domestic producers, to help their domestic industries cope with the crisis. But other governments in other countries, notably Germany and Sweden, said that's not what we do. That's not how we conduct economic policy. We don't pick winners. We don't help industries. We don't buy failing firms. So this variation is really puzzling, particularly in a time of economic crisis. Even in the same industry, there's big variation. So the auto industry was hit very hard by the financial crisis of 2007-2008, and we see them go to their governments and demand help. The U.S. government responds with a multi-billion-dollar bailout for their auto industry, and Sweden says no. The Prime Minister of Sweden comes out on TV and says, people elected me to spend tax dollars, tax money, on healthcare and education, not to buy out failing firms like Saab. So we see this really different variation in how governments are supporting their businesses. And I wanted to know why. And as Sarah suggested, I think the answer is politics. I think the reason we see this variation in economic policy has a lot more to do with politics than it does with economics. And I think there are two key things going on here. I think one, different politicians face different incentives in the groups they're going to respond to. And two, it has to do with the structure of a country's economy. So as I said, I'm only looking at democracies here, but we know not all democracies are the same. We know not all democratic elections are the same. Some, the paths to office in different governments are different. So in the UK, you compete in these geographically defined electoral districts for one seat, and the candidate with the most votes wins a seat. In other countries like Norway or like Denmark or the Netherlands, you have parties that are really competing to maximize their share of the national vote, because that's how they maximize the seats they control in the legislature. And then the parties choose which candidates are going to fill their seats, not the voters. So this creates really different incentives for politicians and parties to respond to different economic groups, different economic interests in their economies. So the institutions matter, but it's the institutions combined with economic geography. We know that economic geography is different for different industries and different countries. So, for example, we know in the United Kingdom the coal industry is geographically concentrated in northern areas, the finance industry is geographically concentrated in London, and this matters. It matters for politics, it matters for politicians, because they have varied incentives to respond to different groups depending on where they are and how geographically concentrated they are. So, for example, in the United Kingdom and in France, we know to win office they have to focus single-mindedly on their geographically defined electoral districts. There's this great quote in my book where one of the French legislators said, you know, a legislator in France is a gardener, and my constituency is my garden, and my job is to go to Paris and get fertilizer to bring home to help my garden. Subsidies can be that fertilizer, but only if there are industries geographically concentrated in her district. So subsidies are a useful tool to win election, to win re-election, only if there's a relevant geographically concentrated group in that district. So we see in France, for example, there's an example in my book where the representatives from a particular region in France, Charente, they go and they demand subsidies for producers in their district that are producing cognac. And they come from all different parties, not just the government party, but also the opposition party. They go to the floor of the legislature, and they demand subsidies for their constituents. And they say, their quotes say, this is not about party politics, right? This is not about national politics. This is about my constituents. I need to protect them because they're in economic crisis. In contrast, in a country like Norway, you have parties that are competing against each other, and they're really trying to maximize their share of the national vote. So they're looking out for groups that are more dispersed across the entire country. They can sort of take a broader view, and they're not just worried about a group or an industry that's concentrated in one district. they're interested in industries that are more broadly diffuse, like the construction industry. It tends to employ people across the country, or the tourism industry. There's a great example from Norway that I'm sure Hilde might talk about more. It went through Innovation Norway, where the Norwegian government, for a still, as yet, I believe, undisclosed amount of money, paid Disney to use the exclusive use of the marketing rights for the film Norway. They did this in order to promote tourism in Norway. It looks like it worked. Tourism numbers, by some measures, doubled after the film was released. And this was a way in which the government could use their financial power. They were using taxpayer dollars to pay Disney to use the marketing rights to the film Frozen in order to benefit this geographically concentrated group. It's a very interesting example. There's a similar example in my book from Austria, where you see the Austrian government providing a tax break, which is a form of assistance, to farmgate wine merchants. These are merchants that sell wine at the place it's produced. And the government parties came and they said, we need to provide the subsidy to our farmgate wine merchants, A, because they're spread out, and so everybody across the wine regions will benefit, and B, the Minister of Finance said this, the Minister of Finance, they never support tax breaks, but he came out and said, we need to do it to help our tourism industry. Again, this geographically diffuse group that's going to benefit people across Austria. The only people that opposed the subsidy were the opposition party, the FPO party, and they did so because, and this was the argument they made in the legislature, because it didn't benefit all Austrians equally. A legislator from the opposition party stood up and said, I'm not going to support this subsidy because people in Salzburg, so this area by the border that doesn't produce wine, they can't benefit. There's no farm gate wine merchants in that region. It's unequal. It's unfair because not everybody is benefiting equally from that. Interestingly, this legislator said that even though he represented Austria's biggest wine producing region. So he went against his own constituency in order to promote his party's policy. So I think this combination of political institutions, how you get elected, and economic geography is really important. I think it can help us understand why businesses and industries and sectors of the economy win support. I think it can also help us understand trade wars. In the very beginning of my book, I had this little vignette talking about, oh, what's Trump going to do with steel subsidies? And when the book was finished, he hadn't decided yet. But we know he since implemented 25% steel tariffs on foreign imported steel. He did it because of politics, because he knew to get elected, he had to win the Electoral College votes in these big swing states, Ohio and Pennsylvania, and the steel industry happens to be concentrated in Ohio and Pennsylvania. So on the campaign trail, he promised them protection, and now he's delivering on that protection. So I think my argument can help us understand not only domestic politics and domestic policy, but also international economic relations and potentially trade wars. And I'll stop there.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, many thanks for the invitation and congrats on your book, Stephanie. It's a really pleasure to be here tonight and get the opportunity to share some insight from Norway. As it was mentioned previously, I'm more on the execution part. It's more how to win when we decided to spend. But I thought for the next couple of minutes, I will take you through the following. First, just a short background on Norway's potential. And second, Innovation Norway's mandate and priorities. So in September last year, Norway reached an important milestone when the value of the Norwegian Wealth Fund went about $1 trillion. In fact, today it's the world's largest sovereign wealth fund, and Norway is among the richest countries in the world measured by GDP per capita. Norwegian women are worth more than oil. That's a quote from the former Norwegian Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg. And it highlights Norway's continuous focus on diversity and also female participation in work life, which has actually increased from 50% in the 70s to almost 80% today. And that's well above the average industrialized OECD countries. If you look at economic development and trends, Norwegian public finances are boosted by the significant revenues that we have received from the oil and gas sector. Norway today is in the top five global exporters of crude oil. And oil and gas sectors, they contribute today about 22% of the Norwegian GDP and also 67% of the Norwegian exports. We also, in Western Europe, the most important source for natural gas. So often we compare to both Denmark and Sweden, but as you see from this overview, we're actually more similar to Ecuador when it comes to what we export. In terms of looking ahead, it's like Norway, despite the low oil price, it's still going quite well. But we have, like similar to other countries, an aging population. And also for Norway, if we wanted to remain as inclusive as we are today in terms of income equality, labor participation, and gender gaps, then we need the business sectors to diversify to non-oil sectors and continue to exploit opportunities within globalization and also technology. So in terms of how can we contribute, and in terms of Innovation Norway, we are the most important instrument for innovation. We support companies in developing competitive advantages and also enhance innovation. So our programs and services are intended to create more successful entrepreneurs, more enterprises with capacity to growth, and also more innovative business clusters. We see ourselves as a promotional bank, and annually we managed approximately £730 million in funding being made available to Norwegian industries through us. And not at least, what problems are we trying to solve in Norway? As mentioned previously, Norwegian economy and also Norway wanted to transist into away from the petroleum-based economy, and we aim to be a forerunner solving global climate and environmental challenges. And in terms of that, we regard Norway to have strengths and opportunities to add value into those six areas. And also tomorrow we have a big launch actually in Norway. Our CEO, Anita Krohn-Torset, she will give our annual innovation speech. And tomorrow she will be joined, among others, by our Prime Minister, Erna Solberg, and also the former Prime Minister, Gro Harlem Brundtland, as well as more than 1,300 guests. And the occasion is the launch of our new digital platform promoting pioneering green and sustainable export-ready solution. Thank you.
So now I'm feeling even more jealous. Chris, if you want to...
Thank you very much. Thank you, Stephanie and Hilda, for your contributions. Both of the previous two speakers gave, if you go back to a sort of a Shakespeare analogy from Hamlet, they gave the method side of why subsidies might exist. I'm going to start off with an anecdote which shows the madness side, or the cock-up rather than the conspiracy. This is a slightly... I probably shouldn't give this anecdote because we were sworn to secrecy, but it did appear very briefly for 15 minutes on the Times' website before a certain one of Britain's institutions said, if this stays on your website for any longer, we'll never speak to you again. And then they took it down, and the rest of us then didn't feel we had to write the story. This goes back to October 2008, at the heart of the financial crisis. I was in Washington reporting for the FT, at the International Monetary Fund annual meeting. Everyone knew that it was, things were pretty bad, but you didn't know just quite how bad they were. The central banks, just a couple of days earlier, had a coordinated interest rate cut, and people were wondering how much difference that would make. And one of the things that we as journalists do when we go to the IMF meetings, this is a UK thing, is we go very early in the morning, often to the British Embassy, which is up on Massachusetts Avenue, beautiful, often really lovely weather in the autumn, meet the Chancellor or Bank of England Governor or some very important officials, and they'll sort of brief us on what's happening at the meetings and what they're trying to get out of them. And this often helps us write things that are informed without actually naming them, so they get their positions across without necessarily having to defend it, or they can deny they said it after. So everyone's happy about this arrangement. Anyway, so we rock up at very, very early in the morning, and a very senior official says, last time I was remember a full morning as beautiful as this was when I was first in Washington 40 years ago. Little did I know then that I'd come back 40 years later in a senior position on the edge of the implosion of all of Britain's banks. And, you know, as journalists, you think, that's not a bad story. And he went on to say that if we don't sort this out by the end of the week, we will have to nationalise all of the whole British banking system. This is what the Times put up on their website and then had to take down, because clearly if you write that, then you actually, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, and the bank, has to say who it was. And the authorities were very, very unhappy that this was up there. But it showed just what crisis there was. And by the end of the week, HBOS and Lloyds were nationalised. So they did collapse. And that was the biggest, certainly the biggest exercise in British subsidies to an industry in the last 30 or 40 years. And it was entirely by accident. It was not intended. There was previous subsidies in having a very lax regulatory regime, which the banks had wanted, and that was the method. The fact it all went horribly wrong because the banks were irresponsible in using the additional size and power they had led to the very large financial subsidy where Britain had to take over those banks, and the same happening in pretty much every country, shows, I think, that these things sometimes aren't as thought through as we might think they are. That's not to say that you don't have lots of extremely good points, but I think there's also some of these things in government sometimes happen for reasons that aren't sort of in that sort of cynical way because of electoral politics. So, I mean, what do governments do? I think so. Economics, I think, tells us that governments, in a very, very crude sense, do three types of things. When they spend taxpayers' money, they consume services on behalf of the public, health, education, those sorts of things. They redistribute, so they take money from one group of people and give it to another group of people, pensions, often through the life cycle, pensions and for children from working people, aged people generally, and also they regulate. And that can be from things like, think about banking regulation, to land use regulation, to anything. These things are often much more powerful. So when we're thinking about how much subsidies there are, it's actually it's rather difficult to go into the statistics, say, for the UK and find how much influence does the UK government, let's say, have on British industry. Because if you go and look at the public expenditure statistics, you'll find the numbers very small. I did it as yesterday. I think that what was classified in the functions of government as enterprise and economic development is 0.3% of GDP. It's come down over the last 20 years from about 0.5% of national income. Compare that to health, which went up over the same period from 4.5% to 7.5% of national income. So it's tiny in terms of direct subsidies. And we should remember that things that are much more important to politicians are things like health and education. Education, 4.5% of national income, would have been higher, but in the 2010s, we've privatised higher education, essentially, by making you lot pay for it rather than taxpayers pay for it. That was a decision of government. And in trade, we often think of other thought forms of protection for various industry coming from tariffs. Again, those have declined very markedly in almost all advanced economies over the last 40 or 50 years. Last 20 years, the EU tariff, because we're still a member of the EU, the average applied tariff, so that's what we're actually applying on the goods we actually buy, has come down from about 5% in 1990 to about 1.6% last year. So again, this will be the same. It essentially applies back to the Uruguay round of the GATT before the, which also set up the World Trade Organization. That tariffs have generally come, industrial tariffs and even agricultural tariffs have generally come down very significantly. So in those terms, the sort of direct things you can measure have become a lot less important pretty much everywhere and pretty much under whatever electoral system there is. Now, of course, there's always exceptions. You know, the French not letting forgotten who it was, by Danone, the yogurt company, you know, that on strategic national interest grounds. But where you don't, what you don't see in the sort of figures that you can get out of the stats very easily are two things. One is tax expenditures. So we don't know what tax is foregone if we give tax breaks to certain industries. That's much harder to measure, and we know it's pretty important. And there again, I'm not sure electoral systems is governing that. I think actually the size of the jurisdiction is very, very important there. So this is why you get tax havens, because you can give subsidies to whatever you are encouraging in your tax haven, whether it is not a tax haven, Ireland, and giving a subsidy to Apple, because you just get a little bit of business, which is very important to the size of a country with 2 million people in it, Ireland, relative to getting a little bit of business, even if you're letting them off 99% of their taxes, is still very important to you, whereas doing the same if you're with the UK or Germany or France or Italy, where you're big relative to the size of the company, if you gave that same tax break, you would get you'd get very little money. So that is why essentially tax havens exist. And again, it's to do with, it's instead of domestic, the way the domestic systems work, it's to do with the size of the country relative to the world. And this is why you get a lot of international tax competition, mostly from smaller countries thinking that if we cut our taxes, we'll bring in a certain amount of business which is big relative to us, our size, whereas the US, Germany, Britain generally can't do the same. And so this just brings me to the final point I'm going to make, is what have we done in Britain in terms, where have we really been very active in subsidies? And one is what I started with, which was financial services, until, and that came through regulatory action, again, very hard to measure, in being lax on regulation until we had to step in 2008, 2009. And the other is actually not an industry, but it's owner-occupied housing. It's because there, I think, voting really matters. It was that for a very large part of the post-war era, if you did anything that undermined house prices, you would be kicked out in an election. And if you did anything to increase house prices, particularly have harsher land use regulations or planning regulations to stop new build, then this would help your electoral performance. And I'll finish on one point. The very interesting thing about what's happening in Britain right now is maybe the electoral advantage is changing, where now that the owner occupation rate is falling, and falling very rapidly among younger people because house ownership is concentrating, that maybe that we're going to see some quite interesting politics arise out of owner occupation, where politicians have to think hard about whether it's renters they really want to attract rather than home occupiers, owner occupiers in future. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. Before, we're going to open it up to the floor, so if you have some questions for the panel or individual panelists, or just more generally about the book, you can ask that. I'm going to just ask the panel, push you a bit more on the politics side. So I know that we have invited people who are not necessarily political scientists. So I'm not asking for that, but I'm just going to ask you a bit more about the extent to which, when you look at these sort of particularistic subsidies, whether you ever have the sense that there is a kind of electoral dynamic. So, for example, with Norway, I mean, I'm impressed, of course, with the sort of grand objectives of equality and climate change and so on, but I'm sort of thinking, studying Norwegian party politics, that even it's not even beyond sort of Norwegian politicians to want to be re-elected, yeah? And so has it ever been your experience that you thought sort of particular subsidies might also help particular groups, and we've heard, of course, with Stephanie's argument that this would be sort of not as concentrated as perhaps in more majoritarian systems. Does the politics ever sort of come in, or do you think, no, I mean, really, when you get to the implementation stage, it's way past the politics? So I'd be interested in that. And also for you, Chris, I mean, similarly with, for example, the UK, I mean, when we hear about the subsidies that you refer to, it's very sort of southern focused, yeah? And in a sense, with Brexit and everything, it's interesting because, of course, that highlights these geographical inequalities and how, in a sense, it's a part of the countries that haven't necessarily won out in terms of some of these sort of, that have sort of, that's come back to bite the government. Does that mean that going forward, you think that the realization of what that can cost electorally will also then influence policies, for example, in terms of the, you know, industrial policy and so on? I mean, is there a shift? Because electorally, all of a sudden, I think Brexit really revealed a geographical divide that perhaps British politicians had not been as aware of as they should have. So just trying to sort of push the political science angle a bit more. Hilde, please.
Yeah, up in Norway, I think those of you who might know Norway, it's a very transparent country. So it's more like a collaborative approach, even though they compete, the parties in between them, to be re-elected. It's very much the national interest that it's put forward. For us, Innovation Norway, of course, when we get to decide how to win, there is quite a strong measurement on us whether we actually distribute the money that we get in an efficient way. So in that way, there is a mechanism, I would say, to make sure that we work in Norway's best interest. So I don't have the feeling that Norway is actually in any way there is a subsidized and for the parties to win. It's more the Norwegian interest. And also, Norway is quite a small market, so the companies, they very quickly to scale, they need to go abroad. And that's a huge job, and I think now being part of the digital transformation, there is so many concerns and how to compete with larger countries. So I think that's more on the mindsets at the time being.
Okay, thank you.
I think Brexit is a really interesting example of what's happened and how you can think about political science. Some things are difficult because if you think about the most salient industry in the Brexit debate in some ways was fishing. And this is a terribly unimportant industry for Britain. I mean, it's 0.005% of GDP, something like that. It's about a quarter the size of the fish processing industry. Fishing will almost certainly be better off with Brexit. Fish processing almost certainly will be worse off with Brexit, if you're thinking about those two industries. And it's only the fishermen who managed to... They managed to get national salience, and people say, oh, I'm terribly sorry. Wouldn't it be great to leave the EU because our fishermen will be better off? And that has zero impact for Britain as a wider context. Yet they managed to get... So they did an incredibly successful job. A lot of it, I think, is my industry is in some sense to blame, the media industry, because fishermen sailing boats up the Thames, chucking fish overboard, all makes for great pictures, particularly in TV. You can get, again, a salience much bigger than your size. But I think you make a really interesting point about the North versus the South and Brexit and where money is flowing. Now, it's very clear in Britain where money flows. It flows from London and the South East to the North. The subsidies, our state is very, very good at moving money from the richer parts of the country to the poor part, essentially because we have a progressive, mostly income tax system. And so the numbers on this, if London were a country in itself, we would have a budget surplus of roughly 10% of London's GDP. I mean, people can argue about whether it's 8 or 12 or 15, but enormous, about as good as Singapore. That's as and every other part of the country would have much bigger budget deficits than the national average. So London, there's no doubt that London subsidises the rest of the country very greatly, and yet the rest of the country feels that London is this great, awful metropolis sucking the life out of their economies. So I always find this is a bit of a paradox. And it is because of the difference in wealth and productivity and income, and London does certainly suck out skilled people from the rest of the country. And money flows in the opposite direction. There are some figures you can. So how much per head does London get spent on particularly transport infrastructure is well above other parts of the country. Now I was in Manchester just last week at an FT conference where we had one of the MPs from the Cheshire region, a Conservative MP, who's also the Minister for the Northern Powerhouse. We had the Chamber of Commerce head from Manchester and the Chamber of Commerce head from Sheffield. And we just had a keynote speaker saying, if you, as in the Northern Powerhouse region, which is the belt across the northern part of England, ranging from Liverpool in the west to Hull in the east, and there's 16-point-something million people live in this belt, so if it clubbed together as a region, would be a very, very powerful voice in the UK economy and in UK politics. And there was someone from the National Infrastructure Commission said, well, if you really want Northern Powerhouse Rail to go ahead, you've got to agree between yourselves on what elements are most important and then come back to Westminster with a unified voice where you're all asking for exactly the same thing, and with 16 million people behind you, it would be very, very hard to say no. And so I was moderating that panel with the people from various different regions. I said, well, what is the unified voice? And Manchester said, well, what's most important for us is the Manchester to Leeds link, and that's what has to happen first. And then the Sheffield person said, well, what's most important for us is actually the Sheffield part of the link. And you could see immediately there was no unified voice. And I think this is one of the reasons you don't get that same, you don't have the same weight that 9 million people in London can get for Crossrail or Crossrail 2. And that again comes exactly back to political science. It's not necessarily in the national elections, but it's in how regional voices are represented. And because they tend to be city focused rather than the region focused across, where there's a very big population across the north of England, the voice gets diluted, and then actually they don't get what they want, and that's how it comes back exactly entirely to your political economy point. And so I think there it is definitively important. It's not necessarily about how our national elections work, but it's how our Westminster National Parliament links with now our city mayors and our local authorities, and it's all very complicated. And if you don't have a powerful voice, you don't necessarily get the spending you might want.
Okay, thank you. I have many other questions, but before I ask them, I will ask the floor. Are there questions from the floor? Tony Travers? I'll just collect a few and then we can.
Oh, hi, I'm Tony Travers from here at the LSE. Great evening. Congratulations on the book. Some of the industries, certainly in this country, but I doubt it's unique to this country, it's true in the US and other parts of Europe, that have tended to be most obviously in receipt of subsidies, of course, include agriculture, car makers, and to some extent shipbuilding via defence. Now, in this country, in the Brexit vote, and in the United States, in the Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump vote, it does look as if the areas that were receiving these subsidies, on balance, tended to vote for what you might call the populist side, the Leave side. So does this sort of paradoxically suggest that the subsidies were not targeted at winning, or in the end didn't achieve the win, or alternatively, that if they had been subsidized more, they might have had a better chance to achieve the political goals that winning implies for the mainstream governments and parties which have traditionally given these subsidies, but in the end now appear to be, not to put it too unkindly, losing control in a number of countries?
Thank you. There was a question here, the lady here in the front, please.
I'd just like to ask Stephanie, interesting new information for me about the differences between countries subsidising various injuries. How long has this been going on, and does it fluctuate over time on over what political party is in charge?
Thank you. And Eiko Thielemann? In the centre.
Eiko Thielemann from the LSE as well. I wanted to ask you about the role of the EU, which was mentioned in passing. Obviously, the state subsidies have been regulated in the EU context for many years by the European Commission, and I wonder whether that has led to the convergence of some of the variation that you've seen over the years. And I would be interested in your assessment what that means now in the Brexit context. Would we expect very different dynamics in the UK in a post-Brexit world? Yeah.
Thank you, and then we'll take the final for this round. Valtra Schelke over here.
Valtra Schelke, European Institute, LSE. Stephanie, I'm sure your book is meticulously researched. I mean, I have heard you speak, and I'm always very impressed how rigorous and all that is, but I am scandalized by your hypothesis. That has to do with, in a way, I always start my political economy lectures that I say to students, we are not cynical here. Cynicism in politics is too simple. And in a way, one could read, and I would like you to calm me down, is that you have seem to have a hypothesis about vote buying, right? In certain electoral systems, that's a bit more targeted than in others, but in principle, there are politicians are out there to buy votes with industry subsidies. Could there be some other explanation that's compatible with functioning democracies for this?
Okay, so I'll give all of you a chance to reflect on the parts of the questions you find most interesting or provocative. Stephanie, do you want to start?
Yes, I'll start. Thank you so much for all of these comments. It's really helpful and interesting. Tony, I think you're right. They didn't work. They didn't achieve the win. And I think politicians and parties, while they're responsive to these groups, they know that their opportunity cost is subsidizing. And so I think that the willingness to transfer money out of health into subsidies is low. And so I think that there's an upper limit on how much we're ever going to see governments spending on these subsidies. And so it's almost paying lip service, right? We're paying lip service to this group. We're trying to buy as many votes as we can using these subsidies, but there's only so far we're going to go. But I think that's a really important and interesting point. To your question, this has been going on a really long time. In the 60s, we see Britain subsidizing state-owned firms, British Airways, British Steel, and we see the German government saying, no, that's not what we do. So the same patterns have persisted for decades. I did worry a lot. Did it matter if there was a socialist government in office or not? It doesn't matter for the aggregate level of spending on subsidies. Both left and right governments spend the same amount of their budget on subsidies. They may target slightly different groups, though. But if you have an incentive to target, you're going to target, regardless of whether you're right government or left government. Who you target to might change, but you're still going to target if those institutional and economic geographic incentives exist. Eiko, a great question. I expect it from you. What's the role of the EU? Both of my wine subsidies that I've mentioned, the one in France and the one in Austria, were found to be illegal by the Commission. They violated EU state aid rules. So I use that to sort of bring in this discussion of the EU state aid rules that are designed to limit subsidies, and the WTO has similarly different rules that also are designed to limit subsidies. And what I find is that when the incentives are strong, when you have the right institutions and the right economic geography, you violate those rules. So these are excellent predictors not only of where the subsidies exist, but of when and what countries violate EU rules. And so I kind of conclude that these rules don't bind perfectly, that we see countries violating these rules habitually, and I didn't see the convergence that I expected, and that was part of the puzzle why I started this project. They're all bound by the same rules. In my sample, I'm looking at EU countries. You know, I'm looking at countries that are members of the WTO, and they're still doing different things with their subsidies. So I think that's part of the puzzle, and I just think there's imperfect compliance and maybe imperfect enforcement, at least in the WTO, not so much in the EU. Valtra, you asked me a very difficult question. I mean, I am cynical. I think that I don't think it needs to be described as vote buying, but they're responding to the interests of constituents, right? In systems where you're elected in a geographically defined district and you have to maximize your votes in that district, you're responding to the interests in that district, right? You can call it vote buying, but a democratic theorist might call it responsiveness. Mm-hmm. And then if you're a party competing in a PR system where you need to maximize your number of votes, you're looking for where those votes are and you're trying to maximize them. And so I think it doesn't necessarily need to be cynical. It could be about responsiveness. And certainly I think, at least in the PR system, you have this element of moving away from, oh, I'm Manchester, I want the railway here. I'm Leeds, I want the railway here. You have parties that are taking a more global view because they're competing at the national level to maximize their seats. Even when they're in districts like in Norway, they're still interested in maximizing their number of seats. So I guess I'm not quite as cynical as you are, and I think that they're responsive. They're responding. They're responding to constituents. Yeah, it's not cynical.
Hilde, do you have something you want to comment? I mean, we know Norwegian politicians are not cynical, but and some of the other aspects, for example, in the question of the EU, we heard before that the Norway does comply. Is there something there? I mean, do you think complying with EU rules, even on the outside, does that make it harder for you in your job to do things, or is there a bright future for us now outside, soon outside the EU?
That's a tricky one. I could just confirm that for Norway, when it comes to EU, we comply with all the regulations that's set. And for us, it's been working as long as I've been in Innovation Norway, at least, for the things that we're looking after. And I've been with the company since we established Innovation Norway back in 2004. Of course, it can be always things that goes maybe something might go slower than we want, but it's in a way when you're driving innovation as well, it's important to actually have regulations so you have a control mechanism. Mm. And I think that's important as well, so yeah, it's doable.
Thank you, Chris.
Just to comment on a couple of the questions. Tony, I think that the biggest, whether you want to call it vote buying or responsiveness of government, certainly since 2010, since the coalition, has been responsive to the old. If you want to know who was protected from the financial crisis, it was the old. Triple lock on pensions, no cuts in any old age benefits, and to the extent it was the public service that got away most likely from austerity, the health service again, was the one. So, and that was done very much for electoral reasons, particularly from the Conservative Party, who get a lot of their votes from the old. And who was it who voted against the interests of the David Cameron and George Osborne who were heading the Conservative Party in the Brexit vote? Well, it was the old. So maybe we didn't subsidize the old nearly enough. But most people who would say who really bore the brunt or who was really protected from the ravages of the financial crisis, and it was the pensioners, and so they were very, very well protected and yet didn't say thank you in any way to the government of the day. So again, I don't think it has an answer to your question, because maybe we should have given, you know, maybe they should have failed, they should have given them more money, and then they would have been happier. But or it could just be about nostalgia and wanting Britain to be a different sort of place, in which case no amount of money would ever have done it, and he might have had other interests which might have helped you win that was certainly David Cameron and George Osborne's mission. in terms of where we go in Brexit and subsidies is really, really interesting. Now, the two main parties have very different positions on this, which is that the government position, the Conservative and DUP position at the moment, is that while we're leaving the single market, customs union, X, Y, and Z, we are willing, they've said they've put on the table to be absolutely willing to buy, to be bound by EU state aid rules in perpetuity and have that in a treaty obligation for the UK. Now, this is in Theresa May's Florence speech, I think, that it's, she's willing to be entirely bound by EU state aid. And this is the concession to get a good trading relationship with the EU. And Labour's position is this is the thing that we, the reason we'd like to leave the single market is so that we can do some of these things which we can't do at the moment. So this is right at the heart of British politics and where the debate is going to get very interesting. So in it's one of those things that you could imagine could give Labour an excuse, like in the Maastricht debates of the early 90s, that it was because John Major didn't sign up to the social chapter that they felt they could vote against the Maastricht Treaty in Parliament. That, again, here you can imagine that even though they will present themselves as a pro-European and maybe wanting a closer relationship with Europe, but because we can't sign up to the state aid regime, that they can then vote against the Brexit bill. So I think there's all sorts of very interesting politics that can play out on precisely these grounds, and it's a really live area of politics. And again, I'm not sure what the ultimate position of the this is, being cynical, that even though they might all in the end want to make Britain a better place and have their own views of doing this, there'll be a lot of cynical politics going on in precisely that area in the next 6 months or so.
Okay, we'll take a second round of questions. The gentleman here in the sort of middle, here, if you go. You can introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Ujwal in the International Development Department at LSE. And my question is, how do governments justify using subsidies in the first place when subsidies are market distortionary activities that prevent the functioning of competitive market economy that's important for economic growth? So why is this happening in the first place?
Someone else who's not cynical about politicians, who believes that they really only care about the greater good. There's a question here. And they're also not cynical about the markets. There's a question here in the front, please.
Oh, cheers. Paul McGrill, Peace News. I suppose this is directed more to Chris Giles. If we look at the three, Germany, France, and Britain, in light of Emmanuel Macron trying to change the way things are done in France, there are three different models. I mean, Germany, no, very little subsidies, but they get people sitting down, companies and the banks and the unions, corporatism, whatever you want to call it. France subsidized, protected unions and whatever. Whereas Britain, it's to an outsider, it's quite amazing that what you do is you, Britain industry failed, so you get the foreigners in. Everything has been sold off. You know, the car industry, energy, water, transport, everything. So, does in that context, does that work better than subsidies from the central government?
There's a question here.
Hi, I'm from the government department. Congratulations, Stephanie. And I think on top of being cynical and exaggerated, the major contribution of this book is talking about how geographical distribution of economic activity interacts with politics, influence the outcome. We all know how, not all, like we know a little bit about politics will affect outcome, but that interaction is a key point. So following on that, I have a question related. So now we talk a lot about gerrymandering, which will affect how economic activities distribution. Mm-hmm. Have you thought about like thinking how that will affect the electoral incentive, how we will predict this kind of subsidies, especially like in America and also in Europe. Thank you.
Thank you. A question here in the front, please.
Hi, Dennis. I was just wondering, to go from a different perspective, do you think there is more a moral reason behind government subsidizing different things so they don't want the industry to fail, because then that's it's bad for the economy if it does, rather than just if we give them money, they'll vote for us?
So again, someone thinking you're a bit too cynical about politicians. So I'm going to just lob in my own question, and then we'll take a round. And that's we talked about, you know, are we too cynical about politicians? But I'm wondering about voters. So it seems to be that you're sort of assuming in majoritarian system that if the politician's strategy, cynical strategy to be responsive or to buy votes, whatever way you want to look at it, is successful, it relies on the assumption that voters in those constituencies will reward them for bringing back the pork or fertilizer for the garden. Yeah. Now, I'm wondering, that might be the case in the States, but in Europe, I'm wondering, is that the case? You know, like Stephen Hammond, he's the MP in my constituency in Wimbledon. He tried this in 2017. All his posters were all about, look what I've done to the bins and Crossrail, and I'm the local police station. He didn't talk about national politics at all. Why? Because he was on the wrong side of the Brexit debate. I mean, he was on the right side, but his party was on the wrong side. Yeah. So his party got punished. He still got reelected because he had a rather large majority and the other party sort of had the same view on Brexit. But anyway, but why did he get reelected? Because I think ultimately voters vote on the party and not on the sort of the party. Big political questions are set by the party. So I'm sort of wondering, I mean, how does that work from the point of view of voters? Is it just that parties overestimate how much voters care about what they bring home? Or is it that voters really do sort of think about the local politics? And because when you look at, for us who study electoral behavior, in Europe it's all about the party. So that's, you know, this is sort of another way of looking at that question about, you know, how cynical are voters when they vote. I think we'll start now with you, Chris, and then move on so that you get rightly the last word tonight.
Okay, does getting the foreigners in work? I think was essentially your question. I think the answer, when if you look in the very grand scheme of things, if you look at say Germany, France, and Britain, economic performance in all three over the last there's been a period over the last 30, 40 years where each one of the three has been seen as the most successful and the least successful. So I think in lots of ways you can say that, you know, there isn't a single model that works and other things don't work, and a lot of it is path dependent to your own country, that you couldn't run a German system in France or Britain very easily. It would take a very long time to get that to work, and Britain's desire to get foreigners in came essentially from the implosion of our post-war economic system in the 60s and 70s. And the need, particularly, and the sort of learning by example from particularly the Japanese companies that came in the auto industry at first, that was a spur to revival rather than a destruction of our car industry. So I think it is sort of slightly a boring horses for courses answer I would give there. And just on the other questions about why do we have subsidies, or are there moral reasons? I think, you know, in terms of literally governments handing out cash, that is quite small beer. The things that you really need to look at are, I think, where things are much more important are on the regulatory side, where no money changes hands, but governments put in systems, and particularly if you think about financial services in the UK, but also in other countries. Before the crisis, we were very proud of our light touch regulatory system, which was entirely essentially done because the financial services sector were complaining about onerous regulation, and the government rather liked the tax revenue that was coming from the financial services sector, which was a quarter of corporation tax, for example, and didn't think that what happened could happen. So, you know, with perfect foresight, I mean, there wasn't anyone who thought it was like going to happen in the way it did, but had we known what would happen, we wouldn't have had that regulatory regime, because it cost us a fortune. But that's what happened, and it was not very sensible.
Hilde, do you have something you want to?
Not exactly on that
part, but I think one thing that's from my daily work that I experience now, I think can influence big time this, what you touched upon on the book, and that's the digital development that we see. And every day we're working with different industries. We see now that they are moving into a digital world. It means that they will start to lease equipment more than they actually will own their own equipment. So large companies within oil and gas, for instance, I visited one in Oslo last week, and they collected more than, I think it was 4 trillion data points, and that was within a year or so. And they said it increases by 200,000 to 300,000 per second. So, and that's the world that we're moving into. So in terms of for the government to keep up and subsidizing or not, it's I think that would just add to the complexity of what we're discussing.
Thank you. And Stephanie, finally, last words.
Thanks. I think you two are asking quite similar questions. How do we justify subsidies? And I mean, they do create distortions, which is why they're regulated by the EU and the WTO, but they can also help growth, right? And I think that Innovation Norway is a great example of this. The way they subsidize is often quite clever, and they're sort of trying to target industries where they're going to see growth and help to diversify their economy. So I think that I've often been talking in my examples about declining industries that need support, but governments can also use their resources and their power to help industries grow and to achieve. And that might be a moral argument for why we're doing this, is not only to save some declining industries that we think are culturally important. So there's a lot in my book about the French film industry, which is this cultural industry that they want to keep hold of and they want to promote, but also that it could help growth, right? It could help a country like Norway diversify by subsidizing different industries. Tingwa, you made a really important point, and I thank you for making it. A huge part of this book is this sort of focus on economic geography, and I think we've heard from both Hilde and Chris that economic geography is becoming more and more important. In some countries, we're seeing an increased concentration of renters, an increased concentration of skilled workers in London, for example. And as economic geography changes, our politics are going to change and our policies are going to change. And I think that there's more and more great data out there about economic geography, and we need to be using that to try to better understand how economic geography and the geographic distribution of workers, of renters, of skilled laborers, of capital owners is going to shape politics and ultimately policy. And I think that one of the questions that's come up again and again, I think, is really still an open question. Do subsidies actually win votes? There is some evidence that they do. In my book, I'm just assuming that politicians and parties are acting as if they do. But this is something we need to push harder on, I think, as sort of scholars, is can we find evidence of this connection between actually providing subsidies and winning votes? I think that, you know, maybe for the average voter, no. But there is good research that I've been doing and that you've been doing that shows that how your community is affected by the global economy affects how you vote and how you feel about the government. So even if you're not a direct recipient of a subsidy, if you live in a community that's a declining industry, if you live in Leicester where the textile industry was decimated by low-cost foreign imports and it wasn't saved through subsidies for some sort of reason, that's going to affect how you vote, even if you're not directly employed in the industry or directly affected by the closure yourself. So I think that I would just conclude by saying economic geography is becoming increasingly important. We see regions winning and regions losing, and this is part of the growth of inequality, is this shifting of economic geography and this sort of increased concentration we see of workers, skilled workers, wealth, and industries.
Thank you so much, Stephanie. And on that note, before we thank the panel, I want to thank all of you for coming and for asking really excellent questions and for not being cynical about the world. And also announce that there will be a drink reception. So good for you for all staying to the end and out to the left here,
in the atrium gallery.
So just when you come out to the left. And also that you will have seen that there's this flyer on your chairs. It's extra good because it actually gives you 20% off this magnificent book if you want to learn even more. So I will encourage you to go to the publisher's website. So thank you so much to the panel. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Hilde. And thank you, Stephanie.